Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome back to another week of the Inside Lacrosse Division One Men's Podcast with your host Dan Flynn and Terry Foy. You can follow us on Twitter at Terrence Foy and at D underscore Fly, or send us an email at tfoy@insidelacrosse.com or dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. On this week's show, we're going to talk about the Masters and some other sports events. We're going to hear about Terry's bachelor party weekend in Cleveland with his boys.
It wasn't my bachelor party. It was another guy named Terry, but not mine.
That's exactly what I said. We're going to hear about Terry's bachelor party weekend in Cleveland.
You can understand how the audience would be confused.
We will talk about how the NCAA has finally made an announcement about the Final Four and the quarterfinal locations for 2017 and 2018. We'll hear about some coaching comings and goings, who's on the sidelines and who is not, and we will get to the games. So let's get started.
Nailed it!
Terry, besides the lacrosse this weekend, one of the biggest stories was obviously at the Masters. Did you get a chance to see any of it?
I did. The limitations on my ability to watch lacrosse, which we will get to over the course of this podcast, were not a part of my limitations to watch other sports. So really this beginning section that we on our weekly agenda have labeled as nonsense
or banter
is going to be a little extra special this week.
I can't wait. You teased me with it, but you wouldn't tell me exactly all the details, so I can't wait to hear about it.
No doubt. So yeah, I guess the last week we hit on some of the hot takes as it related to the NCAA championship. Started with Jay Wright's reaction or non-reaction to winning a national championship. So let's start with Jordan Spieth's reaction to having to put a green jacket on Danny Willett.
That is a lot for any man to be tasked with. You know, that's the tradition, is the reigning champion puts the jacket on to the new winner, which is a cool tradition, because usually the person who won the year before doesn't lose in heartbreaking fashion like that. So to ask anyone, let alone a 22-year-old guy,
who had previously waved off cameras from getting him in the face.
Yeah, it was a tough situation. I really felt for him. It's a strange thing. Last year he won by 18 strokes. This time he had a four-shot lead as he went to the back nine. And he was in so much complete control, wire to wire to that point, for basically 2 years in a row. It was like Jordan Spieth is
the Masters. Yeah, he is the master
of that Augusta course. And to see him fall apart was heartbreaking and gut-wrenching.
So the next question I have is, there are two considerations. First, it's a lot of people just focus on a quad, but it was bogey, bogey, quad. And then the second question is, where do you come down on that, and then you completely fall apart, is pretty clearly a choke. I think I don't like that word. I don't use it very often, but here's the wrinkle, is that he went, you know, he had two birdies over the next three holes and put himself back in contention. Like, there has been some dispute over whether or not that mitigates the choke. And I would say the ability to battle back at least mitigates it to some extent. What do you think?
It was a choke, or the wheels completely fell off. You could see it happening. But at the same time, I agree with you there. And I know I'm not really taking a side here, but you are correct. Birdieing the next two holes is what a champion does. And he just couldn't get back there. But the fact that he was able to steady himself and then regain his composure and his confidence and his focus was amazing. And that's why that kid is going to win a lot of golf tournaments. And he's fun to watch play. He's consistent. I said this, we were watching in the office on Thursday after his first round. He played in the morning on Thursday, I think. And we had it on in the IL newsroom, and I was watching his press conference, and I was remarking to some of the people there who were watching with me, I couldn't believe how composed he was and how much he's matured in 1 year. He's 22, and imagine what you were like when you were 22. Obviously, we didn't have those same experiences where we were sort of a public figure and had to speak in front of a camera or at a news conference often. But he grew up a lot in the last year, and he will win a lot of golf tournaments and will probably win the Masters again. That being said, there was someone on ESPN.com who wrote, who said, I've been covering golf for a long time and sports for about 30 years, and that was the biggest collapse I've ever seen. Or the most incredible story he's ever covered.
Well, it's actually a really good transition to my weekend in Cleveland, because I collapsed on the dartboard on Friday night.
I need more than that.
So playing cricket with a buddy, it would be inaccurate to say that there were no stakes. And we go back and forth for the first two games. I don't even know. Is it a dart match or a dart game?
It doesn't matter.
And then I build a pretty sizable lead. I've got, you know the rules of cricket, right, where you have to close out the 20 through 15 in order to then go for the bullseye. And I close out with probably like a 3 or 4 point, I don't know, whatever you would call a hash mark in a circle, advantage. So probably about 2 rounds worth of going after the bullseye. And so I close out with one dart left, and I get the outer ring of the bullseye. So I only need one more bullseye in order to close out, and I probably have 3 turns to do it. I mean, it was just 9 consecutive, nowhere near the bullseye throws. So you got to go.
What happened?
I think I got Spieth'd. So you got to go double or nothing in that scenario. And it wasn't as bad, but it was not that much better. Similar situation. Built a lead. I don't know, man.
It's happened to me in cornhole before.
Yeah?
Yeah, you're just confident, you're feeling good, and then all of a sudden you're just not throwing as well as you should be.
We can't move on from talking about Jordan Spieth without mentioning how much he looks like our former colleague at Inside Lacrosse and now colleague at Lacrosse Magazine, Cormac McLaughlin. Have you seen that before?
I didn't notice it. I see it in your notes here. I'm not going to say you're wrong, but...
but I'm not right.
I'll take your word for it. You know Corey better than I do, but... if Corey was an incredible golfer, maybe.
He's an incredible tennis player, so I don't know that we I don't know that we know that he's not an incredible golfer.
I've played him in tennis. He's a good player.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do kind of look alike. So Terry, I want to hear more about your Cleveland story.
So it was a bachelor party, because as you do, you go to the Vegas of Northeast Ohio for a bachelor party. It was one of my high school and college friends. He was the best man in my wedding.
Erie?
And Erie is not the Vegas of Lake Erie.
Okay.
First of all, Erie's in Pennsylvania, not Northeast Ohio.
It's as close to Northeast Ohio as you can get.
So he's just got too many friends to go to one of those, you know, crazy exotic destinations. So there was like 35 guys that descended.
Is this a high school friend?
High school and college, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So
a double bro.
It is. We spent a lot of time together, and it was a blast. We this dart game that I previously referred to occurred in a commercial garage, which is not nearly as weird and awkward as it sounds, but when me and my friend were the ones who unlocked the door and turned on the lights, it was very weird. Fortunately, there were multiple flat screens, dartboards, pool tables, couches.
Explain commercial garage. Are you talking like an auto place where you just go to get your oil changed?
No, I'm talking like we have a friend who works for a contractor, and they store their vehicles and all their equipment in this huge warehouse. But they also have like a really nice end of the warehouse that has these TVs and pool table and stuff like that. So we basically just needed a space to have a party, and that was the most available space. And then we did a bus tour around beautiful Cleveland, Ohio, hitting some favored watering holes, and then had an establishment reserved on Sunday to watch the final round of the Masters.
Now, last time we were out in that area, we went out with one of my friends from college, Luke Busby.
Yep.
And I've had some great nights out in Cleveland before with Busby. It is a fun town. Or, as I like to say, I find fun, or it finds me, so you can have a good time anywhere.
Well, the development that's probably occurred since the last time you had a nice night in Cleveland was the development of the Horseshoe Casino. So it's not nearly as difficult to find fun, particularly at, 3, 4, 5.
Do they have
in some cases 6 and 7 a.m. as it used to be?
Table games?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They did not treat me well. They did not treat me any better than the darts did.
Oh, that's great, man. That is the opposite of what my weekend looked like. On Saturday afternoon, the Boy Scout Troop 57 dropped off their annual Molt Sale. So I got 40 bags of mulch, which is 120 cubic feet, Terry.
How much coverage you get out of that?
It was about it's a little more than half a ton of mulch that was delivered into my driveway. And I mulched on Sunday. Spent a lot of out there. It was cold on the East Coast. It was cold. It was rainy on Saturday and sunny a little bit. And then Sunday I got outside. It was good. A gratifying, satisfying experience to spruce up your own property.
As a former landscaper for 5 summers throughout college.
Who didn't do that?
There is something very satisfying about mulching. When you get everything in the place that you want, and mm-hmm. you can tamp it down with the rake, ugh.
But I did that. I went to see Peter Pan. I took my daughter to dinner theater to see Peter Pan.
Like the play?
Yeah, yeah. And then went out to dinner with the in-laws on Saturday night. So my weekend was exactly like yours.
You know, speaking of Peter Pan, I am a distant relative of, I believe his name was Chris Foy, who invented on-stage flight around the turn of the 20th century for a production of Peter Pan. I totally made up that first name, by the way. I have no idea what it actually is.
I thought you could say J.M. Barrie, I think is the guy who wrote the story.
I am not related to him.
But on stage flight, I was impressed with how they did that because it was this tiny little place with the stages in the middle, and it's like just in the middle of the floor of this dining room, basically. And they did have the Peter Pan like go up in the air on some ropes. Shout out to your great-great uncle.
Yeah, that's right.
It was pretty cool. But yeah, opposite of your weekend.
Opposite of Arsenal's weekend as well.
Oh, my God. It's so frustrating to be a fan.
I don't know if we can talk about it anymore. I think that...
Well, we've been requested.
But we're going to. I don't know if we can, but we're going to.
So, a quick summary. They're playing West Ham, a team that is challenging for a top four spot. Arsenal's always challenging to just be mediocre and stay in the top four, if that's what mediocre is. They get a 2-goal lead. Arsenal does. And... they blow it quickly, and they get behind, and they end up with a draw 3-3, which is I've seen it a million times. So this is I'm texting with my nephew, who's also an Arsenal fan, and he sends me the 4 stages of watching Arsenal, and it's Gabriel Paulista, and it's just hilarious pictures. And it's so true. I was so happy when it was 2-0, so dejected when it was 2-2. Distraught and angry when it was 2-3, cautiously optimistic when they tied it up 3-3, and then at the end of the game, you're like, why did I watch that? 3-3 draw, knew that was going to happen. But it was the same guy. They have a big forward named Andy Carroll who dominated. It's like, okay, we're up 2-0.
How about lolloping Andy Carroll.
How about you just cover the big lanky guy who scores all their goals? And they couldn't do it. He actually scored 4 goals, one of which... a bad call, which went in Arsenal's favor. But, yeah, he had a hat trick.
So Arsenal will not be winning the Premier League title. On the other hand, my team,
far from it,
Tottenham Hotspur, which went scoreless through the first half against Manchester United, then just dismantled Manchester United in a way that was punishment for losing to them on the opening day of the season, made everybody forget that Manchester United used to be a powerhouse and remains in contention, I believe, 7 points back of Leicester City for the title with 5 games to go.
Magical Leicester City. I don't think they're going to lose again. So unless you can get like a 5-point victory, you're going to come in second place, which is that's a great season for
Spurs. It's a noble achievement, but it would be disappointing to finish ahead of the 5 traditional powers for the first time in 35 years and not win the title.
I know. I want to explain something to you, Terry. There's this thing called the Champions League, which I think you're going to get to be a part of next year, and it's fun. It adds a little excitement to the season.
It makes watching soccer midweek actually worthwhile.
Yeah, until you get ousted in the round of 16 every year.
Didn't happen the last time the Spurs were in.
Anyway, let's move on. Terry, there's a couple other things happening. Today, we're recording this on Tuesday morning. Tomorrow is a big night. The Golden State Warriors, team we love to watch, is going for their league record NBA win, number 73.
It's an amazing achievement. I mean, thinking back to 1996, I was always kind of on the periphery of being a Bulls fan. Most of my friends were bigger Bulls fans than I was. I mean, obviously, I grew up in Cleveland, so I was a Cavs fan and had seen Michael Jordan eviscerate Craig Elo and Mark Price enough to not fully like Michael Jordan. And ended up cheering for the Sonics in that 96 NBA Finals. Really enjoyed, became a huge Gary Payton fan. Then ended up, Sean Kemp became a Cavalier not too much later on, lived a couple developments over from me. Once passed him going opposite direction, he was in a car, I was on a bike, and I ended up on the side of the road because he didn't see me at all. Yeah, interesting story.
Who was that?
Sean Kemp. He of the 39-inch vertical leap.
And nine kids from eight different women.
You would think that he'd be able to keep an eye out for children.
I know. There's always probably some kid running around him or underneath him. So you would think he would be used to that kind of thing.
Yeah. So
I'm glad he didn't hit you, though.
Yeah, no, I survived. I made it.
Yeah. And another thing, Terry, that happened over the weekend that took over social media a little bit, National Siblings Day. Mm-hmm. When did this become something?
I think this year. I think, like, literally on Sunday.
Because I have five siblings. I'm one of six kids. And I never heard about this. And I don't even know if I have a photo that I could put all of them in. Like, the screen's not big enough in my Instagram.
Right. No, I've got dose brothers.
Dose bros?
Yeah.
Nice.
And I don't think either of them knew that it was National Sibling Day.
I know mine didn't. Like, they're not on social media. Or, you know, they weren't seeing that.
Dan, we got to move on because there's a lot of lacrosse stuff to get to.
There sure is, Terry. So let's move into some news and notes. The biggest news that we were sitting on it yesterday, actually, yeah, and broke it this morning, is that the Final Four for men's lacrosse is going back to Foxborough.
So this is the end of a very long situation that started when the NCAA, prior to the previous award cycle, bid award cycle, grouped as many of their 88 championships, or maybe it's 89 now, together as possible, with the intention of awarding the sites for every location between 2014 and 2018. They chose, because there was so much uncertainty and upheaval in the NCAA Men's Lacrosse Final Four, to hold off on awarding the 17 and 18 Final Four. And we, as an Inside Lacrosse editorial staff, had always acted on the assumption that at some point between probably in December of 2015, if not early 2016, that bid would be announced. So we've been having, you know, side type conversations with different types of folks throughout the industry that might have insight into what was going on. First, in terms of who were the potential candidate sites, and secondly, what was the delay in terms of this awarding. I think it's not a coincidence that the news comes less than 10 days after the NCAA men's basketball tournament comes to an end, 2 days after the men's hockey championship goes to North Dakota. And the news is that Foxborough, Gillette Stadium, will host in 2017 and 2018. There's a lot about this that's surprising and a lot about it that's unsurprising. So let me start with the unsurprising news first. A lot of folks thought that we were going to see new candidates and a potential change to the format in the mix for the 17 and 18 cycle. Those people didn't understand that because the bid process had already begun prior to things like moving the Final Four off Memorial Day weekend, breaking up the semifinals and finals, considering different types of criteria for potential venues. None of those were in consideration for 17 and 18. I think it's a very real possibility, if not a likelihood, that all of those will be on the table for 2019. And I think that over the course of this summer at the NCAA meetings in August, as well as the IMLCA convention next December, we're going to get a fair amount of clarity as to what the future of the event is in 2019 and beyond. As for the other... So that's essentially what didn't surprise me about this. What did surprise me was that they awarded it to the same site for both years. All indications that we had gotten prior to this were that there was a likelihood that they were going to go with the traditional site. You can understand when there's this much money involved, you know, a particular risk aversion. Obviously, with folks talking about places like Denver hosting or Indianapolis being another option, given that both of them have hosted quarterfinals. They were in the mix, I would assume. We don't have a full comprehensive list of who actually bid. Among the interesting developments, we know that Baltimore did not. They are on the record as saying that they did not bid for the 17 and 18 Final Four. And we were told and reported that the Horseshoe, Ohio Stadium, did, which was interesting only insofar as it was a college venue. It meets the requirements in terms of size and other types of amenities, but... It's you know, it's not a professional venue. So that in that way, it was a little bit surprising. I think that there's some conclusions that you can draw. I would like to have more conversations with parties that were involved before, you know, firming up my own conclusions. But Dan, I know that you have a reaction to this award, you know, and I'm curious as to what it is.
Yeah, I think from the fans' perspective, people are disappointed that other locations weren't seriously considered. And maybe
we don't know that they weren't.
But I've been there to a couple Final Fours. It's of the three locations where it's been, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and in Foxborough, in my opinion, it's the least desirable. It's not really, Foxborough is not really in a city. It's between Providence and Boston. It's it is the worst game day experience in terms of, you know, when it's in Baltimore, you can walk from the downtown hotels to the stadium through, you know, the Federal Hill neighborhood, passing
my house.
Yeah, but also, you know, even inside lacrosse, with some other people, have put on a lacrosse festival area in McKeldin Park that's over by the visitor center. In Philadelphia, similar, they have there's so much room, and the parking lots are right outside the stadium. There's room to activate and do things outside the stadium. And then, you know, from a tailgating perspective, a lot of the stuff that happens in Foxborough is across a highway, and it's a long walk. You got to walk through under the road, through some tunnels. They're pretty strict about tailgating policies, yep, and crossing streets. Whereas in Baltimore, Philly, your car's, you know, you can get within a few hundred feet of the stadium outside if you have a parking pass. So in a lot of respects, I think for fans, they're disappointed that it's there. Also, some of the worst attendances or where attendance began to decline, other factors are included, but was when it was in Boston last time or at Foxborough. So,
and that's, to me, the most important conversation to have, because the first thing is you're down to two options. We've already established that Baltimore doesn't have interest in hosting. We don't know for sure that Philadelphia did.
Yeah.
I assume that they did.
But that would give them four straight years there, which isn't a bad thing. But at the same time, if they wanted to move it, their other option, their option to move it was away from Philly.
Right. So that all of that being said, I think we can assume that Boston wanted to host it the most, which is important.
The host with the most.
And I think it's unfair to say two things. The first is, I think I saw the word failure ascribed to a previous Boston hosting candidacy. And my argument is that if you're basing it solely on attendance numbers, every venue has failed since 2008.
Okay.
The second argument is what the event was in 2012 is not necessarily what the event will be in 2017. There have been a lot of economic factors that have changed in terms of people's interest and willingness to attend, and there's also been a lot of trend lines. I mean, in 2012, we had already seen the downturn in the economy without that ability to react to the pricing structure for the event because the bid had already been approved. So the event host was on the hook for all that guaranteed income and needed to do its best to recoup it. So, you know, and I also think that one of the other elements of this is I think that the Final Four, I've said this many times before, is a little bit of a red herring as it relates to being a symbol for the success of this sport in this industry. It was certainly logical to trumpet how quickly it was growing,
yeah,
in the mid-2000s.
I'm with you on that.
But there was a lot of risk to that because so many eggs were put in that basket that other growth indicators of the sport and the industry have been ignored in the wake of the Final Four attendance downturn because of the Final Four attendance downturn. And I think that's, you know, I hate the phrase small sample size because I think it's just something that you can always throw out and, you know, I've seen people like dispute scientifically proven sample sizes. It's just a very, you know, kind of straw man type crutch in an argument. It's one weekend that competes with so much else that's going on, including television and a holiday, that I don't know. There are a lot of other positive indicators, both in terms of fan interest, attendance, and certainly in terms of participation, that to me, you know, a little bit too much is made of that. What I will say about Foxborough as a host, or Gillette Stadium in particular as a host, is there are a couple of things things that you brought up don't apply to me. Because of my responsibilities with Inside Lacrosse, I arrive before the crowds do and I leave after the crowds do. So as a result, I never have to sit in traffic on Route 1, which is something that a lot of people complain about. You know, we make a choice to stay either in Providence or in Boston as a staff. You know, so yeah, we spend some time in the car. But, you know, it's not necessarily ideal, but it's also not uncommon in terms of what it takes to cover games or attend games in a lot of scenarios. So, you know, again, it's not a function of what's like ideal. It's a function of like what is the best possible option. So I don't know. I mean, I personally like the stadium. I like the sight lines. I don't have a problem with, you know, the fact that it's in a shopping center. I think that that's fine. I think that's a part of the development of America. You know, I think that the fact that it's on AstroTurf or field turf is helpful as it relates to, you know, mud insurance when you play five games over the course of 3 days, which is something that Baltimore and Philadelphia are not. They're both grass fields, or at least Baltimore will be for the by the time they would host this in 2017. So, you know, I mean, and not only that, but it's a huge growing lacrosse community that people want to say doesn't deserve this. That doesn't make any sense to me. New England is a part of the fabric of lacrosse in the way that the ability to drive to the Final Four should be something that, you know, that community gets every couple of years, as long as the stadium is interested in hosting it.
Yeah, just to add on to, you made an interesting point about the Final Four being you know, the central focus on is the game growing or is it not? And you make a really interesting point that it doesn't necessarily have to be, and it probably shouldn't. I would hope that, you know, from, again, a fan's perspective who's been there for the Final Four, a lot of it has to do with who's playing and the matchups involved. You know, as a big Hopkins fan, and they weren't there the last time I was there, and that plays into it. But it also is, you hope that the people at Gillette Stadium and on the local organizing committee have learned from past events and will learn from that and grow it and make the event better than it has been in the past, which I'm sure is all part of it too. And they can take the lessons that they learned and, you know, strengthen their product.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the reaction continues to develop. I mean, obviously the 2016 Final Four will have a significant impact on the conversation. If attendance is booming and great, then, you know, certainly there will be people that will criticize the decision even more heavily. If it is horrible, then there will probably be some people that say, well, you know, whatever. What difference does it make? I don't know. We'll see. I mean, like I said, I'm very interested now. I think that there are aspects of this decision that we don't know how the decision was made. And I think that some of that might come out, which will help shed some light. And I also think that there's, like I said at the outset, I'm really interested in seeing how this develops over the course of the summer and the fall as it relates to 2019 and beyond. I think I'd always had my expectations set in a way that, 2017 and 18 were unlikely to deviate very far from the status quo, but I feel differently about 2019.
And in related news, they announced where the quarterfinals will be. The quarterfinals in 2017 will be at Hofstra and Delaware, sort of a north and south location. And in 2018, Hofstra will host again, and Navy will be the host of the quarterfinals. So Hofstra in both years, and then Delaware and Navy in 17 and 18.
That's a clear endorsement of what Hofstra did for the 2013 quarterfinals when Notre Dame played Albany, and it was a sellout, I believe, and, you know, one of the most magnetic and energetic atmospheres I've ever seen. Brings up an interesting point that I want to address, and that is MetLife Stadium and the viability of hosting the championship weekend there. This is all, you know, I'm not attributing this to any one, but my understanding is there are multiple reasons why MetLife Stadium will not host championship weekend. And one that is frequently cited is the cost of what it would take to transport to and house all of the attendees and all the players. That's probably a consideration, but not a strong factor. I think there are two that are much more, that are much stronger. The first is the NCAA, through their sponsorship agreements, have exclusive category partners. If you watch the NCAA basketball tournament for more than a couple of minutes, you would have noticed a lot of AT&T. Coca-Cola is a big sponsor of the NCAA. MetLife Stadium has founding partners. The four gates of the stadium are named after the four founding partners.
So it's not like Gate A, it's the Pepsi Gate.
Correct. Their four partners are MetLife, Pepsi, as you mentioned, Verizon, and Bud Light. So two of them are direct competitors to, three of them, excuse me, are direct competitors of large NCAA partners, and the fourth is an alcohol sponsor, which obviously the NCAA does not condone. As anybody that's ever attended an NCAA event will notice that in-stadium signage is covered up at for non-sponsors, or really all sponsors. You go to an NCAA event at, you know, the Verizon Center or something like that. So obviously, and just by virtue of that, they will host. You know, I went to an NCAA men's basketball quarterfinal at the Verizon Center. I believe the Frozen Four has been there. So they will host in venues that are named after competing partners, but they have to cover up the in-stadium signage. And MetLife has, I believe, a condition with their founding partners that they will not do that. So that is a big hurdle to overcome. And then, Dan, you might know this more acutely than I do, but when New Jersey made steps towards legalizing sports gambling, the NCAA made a statement that they would not host championships and moved some planned championships out of New Jersey. Do you know whether or not that's changed?
I think it was a veiled threat, basically, from the NCAA, and obviously it's not legal in New Jersey. So it's not relevant at this point.
Well, then I think sticking to the in-stadium sponsorship issue as being a primary factor of why, and that's before even, I mean, people just say, like, oh, it should be at MetLife Stadium. We have no idea whether or not MetLife would be interested in hosting the Final Four.
They were.
I guess that's true. We do know that at one time they were. Whether or not that's a hurdle that could be overcome, all of these things are always negotiable. But for the time being, that's kind of the status of this.
Yeah, it would be. It's such a beautiful stadium and a great location for something like that.
Which those of the fans of the Inside Lacrosse podcast will recall us talking about that several episodes ago with relationship to the Big City Classic.
Yeah. All right, Terry. Moving on to some other lacrosse news and notes. Hopkins played their homecoming game Saturday at Homewood Field, a 13-12 much needed win for the Blue Jays in the Big Ten over Ohio State. And Dave Petromala made it back to the sidelines. He's still not out of the woods with his
infection
and an injury, but it was really great to see him back after missing four games.
Yeah, and not a whole lot to add. I think that certainly hope for continual recovery and that he doesn't have to miss any games in the near term. Jeff Shannon was in attendance and commented on how powerful and emotional it was to hear him talk afterwards about what it was like both to miss those games and to return the sidelines. And so, certainly fired up for him and the team and hope for continued recovery.
Yeah, and it was we know some people over there and we've been talking to them, and it was a little scarier than it just seems like. You know, this was a real... a real thing and a painful injury, and happy to see him back. One guy who we won't see back on the sideline anytime soon, Terry, just a follow-up to a story last week.
It's an excellent segue, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I do. Is former Princeton coach Chris Bates, who was dismissed shortly after we recorded our podcast last week from his head coaching duties at Princeton.
Yeah, and, not much to build on based on our conversation from last week, because I think that the tenor of our conversation included, considerations for how many games should he be suspended. Yeah. But within that conversation, I made the comment that there were aspects of the non-associated, and by that I mean not related to the event, the incident that occurred, where I thought that whether or not he would be Princeton's coach next year was still a conversation. You know, so the fact that it came to fruition this way, certainly sad for Chris and his family. And I'm somewhere between quite and very confident that he'll end up in a position that will suit him well, if not better than Princeton. I think that, you know, we continue to move toward an off season that is kind of a pressure release valve for particularly head coaches, but that almost always includes assistant coaches, movement, which has been very stagnant over the last two, three years, depending on your point of view. You know, that cascading carousel will have will bear with it opportunities for Coach Bates. And I think that you know, also discounts the possibility of, you know, maybe taking an interest in coaching at the non-D1 level, whether that's an elite high school program or, a division, you know, being a Division III coach. I think that there will be, like I said, a lot of opportunities that I think will be good fits.
Yeah, so it really comes down to, you know, as an athletic director and you're looking to hire a coach, you know, I said this before, and I still believe it, that what his action in the Brown-Princeton game was not necessarily a fireable offense, but compounded with some other internal things and the performance of the team. I think it was kind of convenient for Princeton to let him go at the time. It makes it easier. They can easier doing it now than, you know, having to wait a little bit, and who knows where the season's going to go. But it makes a question for you, Terry, is what's next for Princeton? You know, and then what is the where would you rank this job, which would be a good segment for a future podcast, comparing like the job, head coaching jobs at different programs. But where do you think they're going to turn?
I think that there are a couple of options, and I was, you know, I've been on the record with these options, so I don't mind saying it again. I think that there are two assistants that you would turn to quickly. Ben DeLuca, a former Ivy League head coach who's now at Harvard. Bobby Benson, who is a longtime assistant at Johns Hopkins and leading the most efficient offense in the country despite not having his top two midfielders. Those are two guys that I think deserve serious consideration. And then, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a phone call placed to Greg Raymond, who's the head coach at Hobart and had been a longtime assistant at Princeton because of his familiarity with the program. So those would be three guys that I would say would comprise like an immediate candidate pool. But I think that the situation is more complicated than that, because building off of my previous comment that I expect there to be other Division I head coach openings, I wonder two things. The first is, does Princeton feel compelled to try to act quickly and beat the carousel? Would they run into candidates that they think should be or are qualified who want to wait, want to slow play it because they don't know what else is going to open up? Some of these guys, not necessarily the ones that I mentioned, but other qualified assistant coaches of top 20 programs might be at schools where their head coach leaves this offseason for a better job or for retirement or whatever. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little bit of the... Let me put it this way. I would be surprised if Princeton has a head coach before the end of the NCAA tournament. A lot of times these hirings have happened between, you know, Selection Sunday and the NCAA tournament. We've seen that a few times, but I expect that the type of candidate they're going to go after is going to be the type of guy who either is involved in the tournament or knows that he doesn't need to act quickly because there's going to be opportunities in the coming weeks after the Final Four.
Are there any Princeton alums that come to mind who are in the coaching? Because I think my Hopkins Blue Jays, and there's, you know, there's Bill Dwan and Bobby Benson who are current assistants. There's Seth Tierney, Brian Volker, Scott Marr, Sean Natalin, and that's just like Division I guys I can think off the top of my head who are current head coaches who would be interested in, you know, alums of Hopkins who could be in the mix for if that job ever opened up someday. I hope it doesn't. I hope Petro is fine and remains the coach there for a long time. But is there a Princeton guy or a couple guys that you can think of?
Not that would qualify as traditional candidates. I mean, there are guys who have coaching experience who might be reasonable candidates, but none of which are not reasonable. outside of the box. So Matt Strebel and Ryan Boyle are two that immediately come to mind. They're not current college head coaches. Matt was a assistant at Princeton for a couple of years. Trevor Tierney is another one like that. None of these guys are current Division I coaches, much less head coaches. So I think that there are a few guys that have been, kind of in and out of the job. One that I would be curious about is, Dave Masbar didn't want the job in 2009. Do you give him a call again and find out whether or not that's changed? So, there are options.
I didn't, the aforementioned Greg Raymond, another Hopkins grad.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another school that's produced as many? I mean, this is
in terms of a roster. In terms of alums, probably not. But in terms of, in terms of alums, if the answer was yes, we would be able to think of it immediately, and yeah. I can't. In terms of who would have as big of a qualified candidate pool, I think Duke is actually in the mix as well, which is kind of bizarre. Not all of these guys are alums, but between who had been like a longtime assistant there, as well as, I would imagine that both Matt, the two current assistants would also warrant consideration in Ron Caputo and Matt Donosky. Mike Murphy at Penn, Duke Joe Penn. Alberici yeah. at Army, Chris Gabrielli at Providence. There are at least two or three
you're
others.
Right. There's quite a few Dukies who are. Yeah,
JB Clark at Limestone.
Is he a Duke guy?
He was a former Duke assistant, coached Bob Carpenter.
That made me laugh. I don't know.
Actually,
why.
Yeah. I mean, so of those guys, we named three Duke alums in Cassis, Murphy, and Matt Donosky. There might be two more. I can't think of them right now.
Interesting list. Interesting topic to think about. Terry, one more note just before we get to the games is bracketology. You put your first bracketology out last week.
Yeah, the optimal time of 6 p.m. on a Friday. The only thing to note at this point is the RPI, I've done this for 8 years, looks nothing like it has ever looked before. In terms of the fact that typically you're going to find all five right now, obviously there was a year where there were six, ACC teams in the top 10, if not at max the top 12. As of last Friday, North Carolina and Duke were outside of the top 20. Which is very rare, as well as Syracuse and Virginia were in the mid-teens. With Carolina's win over Virginia, which we will get to, as well as Duke's game against Notre Dame, despite being a loss, both of them have jumped into the top 20. So, that's kind of the second consideration, is that we're only about 70% of the way through the season. So each week we play about, obviously depends on how many games there are, between 5 and 7% of the season. Given the conference tournament week, first of all, those games aren't scheduled, so I'm not counting that into the game, into the total, but also because they happen in such a concentrated span of time that actually ratchets up and then back down. The RPI will change dramatically week to week. It will start to change less dramatically as each week passes. Those are
as
really...
the sample size gets bigger, is what you're saying. Right?
I mean, I don't know if that's a correct. It's not really sample size. It's the divisor.
Yeah, as you play more games.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that a dig?
No, not at all.
All right.
Just throwing that out there. Like, I'm looking at the RPI. You're talking about it, but yeah. There are some people who haven't looked at this. And
absolutely. So the RPI, just for people who are unaware, is ratings percentage index, and it's determined by in men's lacrosse the values change depending on the sport. But in men's lacrosse, 25% of the formula is your own record, 50% of the formula is your opponent's record, and 25% of the formula is your opponent's record. There's a dispute over whether it's a primary criteria for consideration. There are some who have been involved with the committee that will say that it's a ranking structure, more like an organizational tool than an actual criterion. There are some people that would say there's a logical fallacy in not calling that a criterion, because if that's the starting point from which you're working off of, then obviously it is a criteria. This opponent, strength of schedule is based off of a formula that utilizes that RPI as well. So it's very important. It's worth keeping an eye on. We post it whenever we post a bracketology update. you know, I don't want to even get into the individual matchups or the individual, you know, kind of hinge points. Who's going to be the number one seed? Who, what's the swing for who's going to host and who's going to travel? And then what the, what's the situation as it relates to the bubble? The other point that I want to address that is worth following over the next couple of weeks is there are a handful of teams whose RPIs are so high that they are the favorite for their conference tournament. However, the playing game structure requires that the four lowest RPI teams play in the playing game, and then the winner of those two games goes to the top two seeds. There are teams that would arguably get at-large bids who are favorites to win their conference who would be in that bottom four. So Bryant is a prime example of a team that would probably warrant at-large consideration.
Currently number 11 in the RPI.
That puts them in the bottom four of conference AQs as long as Navy wins the Patriot League AQ. So that means that if Bryant wins their playing game matchup, they would have to play a top two seed. If they didn't play, win their conference tournament, got an at-large, they would, by nature, play not a number one or a number two seed, meaning that their matchup would be better. We are looking at a situation where teams could be incentivized to lose their conference championship games, which is insane. Now, there are a lot of factors that go into that. It'll be interesting to see how the NCAA continues with the bracket structure next year when we reduce to 9 AQs, assuming that the ACC does not add a team. And we'll see whether or not there's a consideration for full bracket expansion to 20, removing these play-in games and changing the structure of the tournament at large.
Terry, to give people an idea of how bizarre the RPI is right now, Towson is the number 14 team in the RPI. They're 10-1. I think most people would say
that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. You know, the Tigers fans are really enjoying the season. The number 13 team, Bucknell. I didn't see that one coming. 3-3 in the Patriot League, 7-4 overall. Biggest win over Army.
Yeah.
Is their best win, an 8-7 win over Army. They beat BU and Holy Cross are their other Patriot League wins. And they're 13th in the RPI right now. So how does the RPI factor into the overall at-large? I mean, you know, it's significant win is a heavy factor the committee looks at. RPI is a factor. What else do they historically look at?
I mean, it kind of changes, and that's one of the things. I always say the criteria is subjectively objective, meaning that they use objective metrics, but they implement them subjectively. So on a year-to-year basis, the committee's composition changes, and so their behavior becomes a little bit less predictable. I thought that from 13 to 14, because Jim Sidlitsky spent 2 years as the chair, we saw relative continuity.
And he is?
He's a former athletic administrator with the Big East, then
Big East
went
lacrosse
to the AAC. Yeah. Gene Doris is the chair of the Gene Doris, who's the AD of Fairfield, is the chair of the championship committee this year, and Richie Mead replaces Brian Ankin as a SoCon representative among the you know conference committee. So I'm sorry, you know the way that structured, it's a basically like a seat based thing. So when Brian Ankin was no longer the coach at VMI, he needed to be replaced, and Richie Mee was the selection. So you know it'll be fascinating. I spoke to a coach a couple weeks ago who said, in a very kind of side-handed manner, finally comfortable that we have enough coaches on the committee, because there was a year in which there was one and there were four athletic administrators. So I think that indicates to me that the eye test would be a little bit more a part of this than it has been in the previous 3 years. But aside from that, I can't tell you. I mean, the published criteria separates those three that you mentioned with seven additional criteria. But there are things like, for example, the first one is record. Like, yeah, and we know that you're going to take a team's record into account. Yeah. You know, the balance of home versus away. Well, what does that mean? So, I mean, I can try, but really it's just like, that's why on a year-to-year basis, you see guys like Joe Lenardi be so successful in basketball, and if they aren't, they can almost say, well, the committee did it wrong. You can't really do that in lacrosse. Generally, you know, there are three or four of us that do this regularly and have been doing it for a while, and there's some consensus as it relates to heading into Selection Sunday. That varies year to year as well based on, you know, how crazy some of the results have been. That being said, that all being said, I won't feel as comfortable heading into this Selection Sunday as I have in years past because of the new composition of the committee, in terms of my read on them being as accurate as I felt in previous years. And as we started the conversation, the RPI is so crazy that there's a lot of room for variability there within.
All right, time to move on to the games. Up first, Terry, is Maryland at Penn State on Sunday night. Maryland midfielder Brian Cole scored his second consecutive game-winning goal, this one coming in overtime to lift the Terps to an 11-10 road victory at Penn State. After some back and forth in the first quarter, the Nittany Lions put together a 6-1 run to stake an 8-4 lead. John Tillman, Maryland coach, called timeout, settled his Terrapins, and they came out and scored three straight goals to bring them back into it. Maryland was ahead 10-9 in the fourth quarter until Penn State's Ryan Keenan tied the game at 10. The teams traded possessions in overtime before Cole scored the game winner on Maryland's second possession of the overtime period. Cole finished with two goals and assists, while Colin Heacock and Henry West each netted a hat trick. Kyle Bernlohr was big in goal, especially in the second half. The career-high 14 saves for Maryland. Penn State got two goals and two assists from Nick Aponte and three goals from Mike Sutton.
Because of my previously mentioned commitments, I was only able to watch this on my phone while standing in line to get on the plane. And then, so that was like the last 10 minutes of the fourth quarter. And then I think my plane set a record for how quickly it boarded and took off. So it was horrible because I wanted it to be as slow as possible because this game's in overtime. I got to, like, the ascendant point where, you know, I violated the airplane mode policy, where the data cuts out and I wasn't able to watch anymore. And it was not over. So I had to, like, you know, as soon as I landed, like, immediately get back on my phone and find out who won. To me, I don't know, man. I didn't even see the first half and this felt like a game that Penn State deserved to win. I think it's because it felt like they went toe-to-toe with Maryland and wanted to play their style. It wasn't as if, you know, if you run past Maryland and just, you know, kind of out-transition them, the way that I would envision Brown trying to play Maryland, then so be it. But in the same way that Yale wanted to play a similar type of possession style game that Maryland likes to play and won, that garnered a lot of respect from me. And it felt like Penn State did something very similar. You know, Will Schreiner played pretty well, obviously, with a save in overtime, a huge play. I think one of the things that impresses me the most is that Penn State had a pretty nice offensive day. Putting up 10 on Maryland is a good offensive day. And they did it without Grant Ament being largely productive. I thought he played well, but he didn't have, you know, a 5-6-7 point game the way that I would envision them having to have from him in order for them to have that type of offensive performance. So, you know, it's a tough loss for Penn State in the respect that with respect to the fact that if they had won, it almost assuredly would have sewn up a NCAA tournament bid. Now that I still think that they're in, but you know, it's not to say that they don't have work to do. If they were to lose to Rutgers, for example, I think they would get swapped by Rutgers in the at-large field.
Takes us to our broadcast observation of the week, Terry. There's a lot of people who weren't happy that this game, a Big Ten game, was on the Big Ten network. And they let you know about it. I love some of the tweets that come in, angry tweets about the Big Ten network.
I just want to let everybody know that the Big Ten network is in more homes than ESPNU. Now, I understand that it's regionally located, but not only is, you know, conference networks as well as conference broadcastings the wave of the future, but these guys do a really nice job. And, you know, I think that there probably needs to be an option where you can, you know, buy it a la carte, at least BTN to go, if you can't subscribe via cable. And I think that'll happen in short order.
Do they have that? Do they have BTN to go?
Mm-hmm. That's why I was watching it on my phone. Okay. I wasn't carrying a TV with me.
No, you don't travel light, so maybe you had one with you. Our man Mark Dixon on the call.
Yeah, he did a really nice job.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah. So, and not only that, the other comment that I wanted to make about this game felt really, really intense. Like, really intense. And I don't know if it was because it was, like, Sunday night in State College. It was a little cold. I liked their crowd. I liked the fact that they set the camera up on the opposite side from where they had the Harvard game earlier this year. But there was a moment in the fourth quarter, probably about 5 minutes left, 4.5 minutes left, when you mentioned earlier how pivotal that first half John Tillman timeout was.
Yeah.
Till's got another timeout call that most of the Penn State players did not like being awarded. I've never seen a player from an opposing team yell at a ref for awarding a timeout. I was like, wow, if you're seeing that in this game, then it really means something.
Do you remember the Big Ten Network sort of documentary last year before the Maryland-Penn State game?
I do.
It was really cool. It was great, great television. And when you were talking about the intensity of this game, and I just think back to that and how dramatic it and pivotal that game seemed to be. And I wonder if there's any correlation between how important that game was last year, the rivalry between these two teams maybe, and why that was set up for like a Sunday night primetime type of game.
It's really fascinating because, first of all, I would say that, well, maybe one of the biggest factors is that the intensity reflects both of their team's coaches.
Oh, definitely.
So hard to overlook that. And then the second aspect is these teams should be rivals, you know, in natural settings, certainly in football. They probably belong. I mean, they were rivals from, you know, I don't know how far back it dates, up to Penn State joining the Big Ten in 91 or 92.
A lot of Maryland guys I know really think of Penn State as a rival. I don't know if it goes both ways, you know, that the rivalry needs to go.
Right.
But, yeah, they're natural rivals. I mean, they're states bordering literally the Mason-Dixon line.
And, you know, Penn State probably does best in the DMV area for football recruiting in comparison to any other major program. So, you know, in that respect, stealing players from the Terps' backyard. In lacrosse, though, it obviously doesn't apply because Maryland is rivals with Johns Hopkins. If Hopkins were not a Big Ten program,
right,
then maybe Penn State would represent their Big Ten rival. But since they are, I think it's always going to be a secondary game. What's interesting to me then is, you know, Penn State doesn't really have a natural rival in lacrosse. So who will it be?
Right. Terry, that is a good observation about the Big Ten Network. But at the same time, Saturday afternoon, I was sitting at home, and I love me some ESPN3 on my Apple TV. The games that I was able to get, Richmond, Furman, St. John's, Marquette, Brown, Penn, all going on at the same time. It was just flipping back and forth. I didn't think I would ever see myself watching a Richmond Furman game, but it went to triple overtime, and I couldn't turn out the Hopkins Ohio State game came on TV, and Amy said to me, she's like, why aren't we watching the Hopkins game? I go, it's in triple overtime. I'm invested. I started watching in the fourth quarter, and I had to hang in there to watch a Richmond win that.
Well, then you might be able to help with a tweet that was sent to me. I wasn't able to watch that game. Somebody was asking about the officiating. Do you have any thoughts on the officiating in the Richmond Furman game?
Nothing that I noticed.
Break from the norm. I think that the comment suggested, or the question suggested, that it was a, you know, just kind of one of those region to region. Maybe it's a little bit stricter down south. I don't know.
I didn't really notice anything different. There was a one time when I really thought a stall warning should have gone on, and the Furman broadcasters, who did a really nice job, actually. It was a younger guy with an older guy. I don't know who the older guy was, a former coach with a bit of a southern draw. Mm-hmm. I would love to know who that guy was. They both did a nice job. But I didn't see anything in particular that really stood out to me. Terry, on to some more games. Notre Dame topped Duke 8-6 as the top-ranked Irish saw their offense come to life in the second half of the game. While the offense was finding its footing on a cold, rainy day in South Bend, the Notre Dame defense was squeezing the life out of Duke as the Irish outscored the Blue Devils 5-2 after intermission. Sergio Perkovic led the way for Notre Dame with a hat trick. All 8 of the Irish goals were unassisted, Terry. On the other end, Duke's Miles Jones was held without a goal and just one assist. He had come into the game averaging more than 4 points per game from his midfield spot.
This is another one, and you know, the reason it's second on the rundown is because it's the game that I got to watch the second most of, where I felt like Duke kind of deserved to win. This one, the reason is much clearer, and it's that they led for basically 56 minutes. And you know, Notre Dame's a tough place to play. It's very uncommon in terms of, you know, going to the Midwest, playing in that weather. They get good crowds. Certainly this Duke-Notre Dame game, we were talking about rivalries just a minute ago, is one that has some history to it. I think for me, the biggest observation to pull away is how well John Sexton played. Coming into the season, we talked about a relative dearth of top-end long stick midfielders. And it's been the case for, you know, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, depending on what your threshold is for how many guys you want in the mix for that All-America conversation at that position. But Michael Howard of Virginia emerged as a preseason All-American candidate because he had the size and the strength to be able to match up with Sergio Perkovic and Miles Jones. He's played well this season, but to me, John Sexton's emergence as being somebody that can stay in front of those big, powerful midfielders probably is a function of the fact that he practices against Sergio Perkovic every day, has been really, really impressive. There are a lot of aspects to the future of his career and the way that it fits into Notre Dame's defense that I'm interested in. Particularly, Notre Dame has a legacy of moving their poles down to close defense. Matt Landis is a most recent example of that, and he emerged as a favorite to win his second straight Schmeisser Award. The other conversation that comes away from that, and I think that the turnovers are probably more of a problem than the lack of points, is whether or not Miles Jones is now a viable Tewarton candidate. I was a believer very late into the year, you know, even so far as arguing that he was still the favorite through the midway point. You know, I think he'll probably likely end up being a finalist, but I think at this point, Dylan Malloy and Connor Canizzara are both more likely to win that award than he is. And we'll see how it develops going forward. I thought Quint made an interesting comment in his top 20 this week to suggest that because Duke doesn't have midfield depth, they're going to require a lot of double shifts out of Miles Jones and Dima Klass. And, you know, Miles, because he starts the offense so frequently, especially, is going to have to be in really good shape, particularly as the weather gets warmer.
Yeah, speaking of Tewarton favorites, our next game is the Brown-Penn one. Our own Matt Kinnear was there on the scene covering it, and here's his recap of that game.
Over in the Ivy League, up at historic Franklin Field in Philadelphia, Brown topped Penn 17-6. It was a bounce-back win for Brown after losing a midweek tilt against Bryant last week. Coach Lars Tiffany, after the game, said this game came down to emotional strength, and that started with their goalie, Jack Kelly. Jack Kelly had 15 saves, was crucial in transition, and just played an overall excellent game. Dylan Malloy was a monster like he usually is. 8 goals, 1 assist in the win. This is a Brown team that, you know, after that Bryant game, they could have gone either way. They could have lost a few games there, but they had a really, really strong Thursday night practice in the pouring rain. That led to a game Saturday in the pouring rain and the snow where they just came out with more energy than Penn and just topped the Quakers in a dominant fashion.
Terry, I watched this game. It was really fun to watch this game on TV. There was a almost a whiteout conditions. And at one point, it was so out of reach, the domination of the Brown Bears, that really the only thing left to watch was the beauty of the April snow falling on historic Franklin Field. And that was matched only by the beauty of Tewarton front runner Dylan Malloy's game. I think Matt said 8 goals and 1 assist. I think he had 8 goals and 3 assists. He now has Kyler Bellistri had 3 goals and 3 assists. But Malloy now leads the nation with 66 points on a very balanced 34 goals and 32 assists. He has more goals per game and more assists per game than anybody. He's played less games and almost has more goals than anybody else, too. Like, when's the last time someone led the nation in both goals and both assists?
Are you seriously? I don't know the answer to that
question. That's the question.
Do you know the answer to the question?
No, it's rarefied air. Yeah. I don't know. I can't think of a time. Usually you have feeders, you have goal scorers. You know, example, in Division III last year, Austin Stewart of Lynchburg scored like 113 goals, but only had 12 or 13 assists. You see that occasionally, not of those kind of production numbers.
Rapinoe being like a 20 assist or a 20 goal, 60 assist guy.
Lyle Thompson had some good balance, but more of a goal scorer than the balance that he had.
No, he was more of an assist guy. He was typically at 40 goals, 70 assists.
Good point. But it, just to see a guy lead in both categories is, I can't remember a time when that has happened.
Well, and I think that, you know, certainly when you compare it to last season when Dylan Molloy was a 60-goal, 32-assist guy, he deserves a lot of credit for his ability to step up his playmaking. He's already matched the number of assists that he put up last year. You know, his dominance, his physical dominance is hard to describe. It's fun to try. I've had a lot of fun trying to describe why Kyle Devitt's comparison of Dylan Molloy to a Tonka trunk actually makes sense. That being said, you know, my biggest takeaway from this game is that I thought, and I still think, the Penn is very good. I think they hit the, you know, hard stretch of their schedule and are going to come out of it very scathed, but I still think that they're the favorite to be the 3 seed in the Ivy League tournament. And I think that, you know, setting up going forward, they could beat somebody. I don't know if they're necessarily going to beat Brown or Yale in the Ivy League tournament, and I don't know whether or not they can get to the NCAA tournament. But if they do, I could see them winning. There are a couple points about this game that I want to make. The first is they had 92 shots. That's so many shots, particularly in a game that was marred by weather. Yeah. Obviously, it's a function of Brown building a lead and then Penn having to battle back and just peppering the cage, but they accounted for 52 of those 92 shots. So they didn't have a great shooting day, but they certainly had a good day as it related to getting balls out of their stick in the direction of the cage. And then, you know, this is a comment that's been made a couple times, but really impressed by Brown's ability to respond to that loss to Bryant. I think that it's going to be difficult in retrospect to balance two of the primary factors of that Brown game. The first being the relative distraction of the Princeton game, which Lars Tiffany acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And then also the absence of Will Gural, who, you know, has emerged as a top five faceoff guy in the country and did not play against Bryant, was resting an injury, but did play against Penn. But aside from that, Brown's back on the warpath and they've got a big one coming up this week.
Yeah. Terry, you talked about Penn's NCAA chances and how you feel like they could be. What Matt was saying coming back from this, he thinks Brown can win the national championship after seeing them play in person again. He's on the Brown bandwagon.
Their top end athleticism is certainly as good as anybody in the country. The question I think that most people would have is, are they athletic enough from 15 to 25 on the roster? Obviously, to say to win 2 games in 3 days is something that, you know, it's almost a cliche at this point. I'm not even saying that, just in terms of being able to win matchups against the league competition. And I think that they are absolutely a Final Four contender. I always say any team that gets to the Final Four is a national championship contender.
And the way, my question, I said, well, Matt, how do you feel about their goalie play? And he said, Jack Kelly's a beast. He's playing exceptionally well.
There's no question not to think that he's among the top 2-3 goalies in the country.
So that's a huge thing. And it leads us into our Twitter follow or conversation of the week, Terry.
It's really over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're ironically catching some heat about the cold weather and the snow. You know, there were several games that were played in the snow, and I mentioned that I was watching on ESPN3. Down in Furman, people in the sun basking, fans with sunscreen on and shorts, and then Philly, it's snowing. I watched the St. John's Marquette game that was in at St. John's, and it's miserable. I think there were more people in my living room than at the game at St. John's. It was terrible weather conditions. And there were some people really, like, after you about...
chirping.
Yeah, like, look, it's... how dare it snow in April? There were two different thoughts. There was like, oh, look, it's snowing in April. I guess we shouldn't play games in April. And then there were the other school of thought where it was like, look, this happens, you know, who cares about February? Or why? This is why we should play games in February, because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, which...
Either way,
I'm not on an island here. That's horrible logic, right?
I know, it's great. But I just love that they have to, like, bark at you.
I mean, you know, some people feel passionately about the issue. I'm not going to hate on that one. But my thing is that, like, if you can't concede that it's more likely there will be bad weather in February than there will be bad weather in April, I just really don't know how to argue with you.
Yeah, I remember shoveling some snow in my house in February. I didn't have to shovel any. I mean, just coming down, it was prettier watching the snowy game in Philly than the rain-soaked game in New York. But, yeah, I totally agree with you. People, the chances of it snowing in April or late March are much less likely than February.
I'm certainly not going to argue that it's impossible.
Yeah. It's great. Also, Terry, we have some some of our listeners have been writing to us. And I want to read one from our listener, Nick Spacey. Hey, Terry and Dan, my name's Nick Spacey. I'm a lacrosse coach in England and a massive fan of your podcast. Says some really nice things about us and what we're doing. I don't want to get into that. But he says, my only complaint is the lack of Premier League discussion in your last two podcasts. I enjoy hearing your take on football, soccer. And then he has a couple questions. And mainly it's, what do you think is the sudden downturn in the ACC juggernauts losing so many out-of-conference games? And his follow-up question is, do you think it is the distribution of talent going to so many up-and-coming programs? At the same time, Terry, one of our listeners in Mexico, Javi, wants to know what's going on with Duke. And so those are some questions I pose to you.
I think that, you know, there are aspects of this that are cyclical. We've seen out-of-conference struggles among ACC teams over the last once or twice in the last 5 years. They don't necessarily approach this level. I think the biggest difference is that the teams that they're losing to, Air Force, Richmond, High Point, are more surprising than losing to, say, for example, Ohio State or Penn State or something like that. So that's getting people's attention. Even though those programs are relatively equivalent levels, you know, if it were 2012 when the ACC was struggling, and don't quote me on that, or 2011, you know, those Ohio State, Penn States were, you know, between 15 and 25, which is exactly where Air Force, High Point, and Richmond are right now. So my overall point is just wait until next year or the year after, and the odds are more likely than not the ACC teams are going to go, if not 20-1 out of conference, which I believe they did in 2010 to start the season, probably closer to 80% that were equivalent to, maybe 85%, maybe even 90% out of conference. You know, in terms of getting more acute with the reasons, you kind of have to do it team by team. And so for Duke, you know, I think that one of the things it's funny because it's hard to say in the wake of their loss to Notre Dame. For the most part, it's been disorganization defensively. I think that in Notre Dame, it was the first time this year where I felt like the lack of Joey Manown was, and that explosiveness at the attack and the ability to then focus so much of your defensive attention on Miles Jones and Demer Klass was the first time that it cost Duke a game. I think that I still, you know, I'd rather be late on saying that Duke is dead than early. I think with North Carolina, they lost so much leadership from their senior class last year that their inconsistent performances to start the year they should have been expected, I guess is the best way of putting it. You know, Hofstra caught them. UMass beat them toe-to-toe. I don't know. I wasn't able to see much of either of those games, so I can't speak to it directly. Virginia's struggles, I think, are a little bit more widespread, where it's just kind of like an aggregate not playing that well. So, I don't know. I feel like Notre Dame is among the best teams in the country, and Syracuse is not that far behind where you would have expected them to be this year. So that's my general answer there. You know, Javi asked specifically about Duke, so just, you know, one more thought on that. I made the point many times early in the season that their lack of midfield depth was going to make it very difficult for them to score, particularly in pivotal situations. And I believe that has come to fruition. I was impressed by their increased organization defensively. I wonder if they can get that consistently going forward, because, you know, certainly they can win faceoffs. I've been impressed by the way that Kyle Rowe has continued to improve over the course of the year, and stay healthy. The other big problem is that they kind of only have one guy that you feel confident can run past his matchup consistently.
You know, you sort of set up, Terry, we're on the subject of ACC. There was a game down at Chapel Hill on Sunday. Both teams, North Carolina and Virginia, came in riding a tide of momentum. UVA had a 3-game winning streak. North Carolina was fresh off last week's scintillating 17-16 overtime win over arch rival Duke. Well, Virginia is going to need to start a new streak. This one was all Carolina, Terry. The Tar Heels reeled off 9 straight goals by winning almost every faceoff to stake a 10-1 lead and never look back. It was over early. As Quint Kesnick said in his weekly article on InsideLacrosse.com, When the Kellys are playing well, UNC is unbeatable. Well, that happened on Sunday. Stephen Kelly.
Hold on, wait. You left out the best part. When the Kellys are playing well, UNC is almost unbeatable. Because there are like 15 Kellys on the team.
Yeah, there are.
Quinn was on fire.
Yeah, he was.
He made me laugh like four or five times.
Yeah,
in his
I did like his. What was his RPI line?
Mr. RPI, who didn't go to RPI, doesn't like Bucknell.
And took more math classes than I did in college. Stephen Bones Kelly won 17 of 25 faceoffs, many of them during that stretch. Timmy Kelly led the team with 4 points on one goal and three assists. And Patrick Kelly joined five other Tar Heels who each scored two goals to lead the route. Balcom was good in the cage, made 14 saves. For the Cavaliers, though.
Worth noting that that was a change from the end of the Duke game where Ryder came out in relief.
Yeah. James Pinnell led the way with a hat trick. Matt Barrett, who was overwhelmed during that 9-0 run in the first half, did manage to come back and make 12 saves overall in goal for Virginia. But it leads us to into this week's games coming up, Terry. There's seven midweek games, the highlight of which is Notre Dame. Number one Notre Dame is playing number 17 Marquette. Marquette's playing very well. That'll be Wednesday in South Bend. But there's a big game this Sunday when Duke plays Virginia at noon on ESPN2. It's almost a play-in game for the ACC tournament. Both of these teams are in the basement, have one win each. I think Virginia's 1-3 and Duke's 1-2.
No. So Virginia's 0-3. So Virginia would have to win in order to create that three-way tie.
Yeah. So it's a big game for both teams, which. Coming into the season, there were some predictions about how the ACC would shake out, but you just think of these teams as like really needing a win to get their NCAA tournament chances sort of jump-started.
Yeah, well, and I think that, the Virginia issue in particular is fascinating. We've talked about this. I don't remember if we talked about this on the podcast. I've, kind of had this conversation with a number of people, but they're in a really unique situation where because Brown is so good, and because Brown will be playing in the showcase game versus the fifth seed in the ACC, and then having to fly back from Atlanta and play in the Ivy League tournament the subsequent weekend, that it could be advantageous for that fifth place team. To get a win over Brown would be more valuable than losing in the first round of the ACC tournament to either what's shaping up to be Notre Dame or North Carolina. Certainly, I mean, that's what's most interesting about the way that the RPI is shaken out. At this time last week, I would have said it's beneficial for everybody if Syracuse ends up as the number 2 seed. I don't think that their RPI is going to be helped by playing Cornell. So at this point, it looks like if I were betting, Carolina would be a more valuable opponent for either the third or the fourth seed than Syracuse would. Virginia versus Brown in the fifth place game raises some interesting ideas.
What are they, Terry? We've spoke about this before.
The Mile High Classic, the Whitman Sampler Mile High Classic in 2012. Denver was very good. Mark Matthews, Alex Demopoulos, et cetera. Chase Carrero. They had lost to Loyola twice in played Duke on the last week of the regular season. And Duke started an unconventional lineup. The Pioneers went on to win and secure an at-large bid into the NCAA tournament. Bill Tierney and John Donowski are well-known friends. Lars Tiffany and Dom Strajar are well-known friends. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying it's an interesting.
What exactly situation. Are you saying?
I'm not saying anything. I just said I'm not saying anything. I think that it could be in Virginia's best interest to be the fifth seed.
Yeah.
In the ACC.
I mean, because if they beat Brown, it certainly would be a good win for sure. I'm looking at Duke has Virginia, Marquette, and BU. Conceivably, they lose. They're 7-6. Virginia's other factor is they're 6-6. If they lose to Duke, they fall to 6-7. They play Georgetown to close out their regular season. I think they get a win there, so they're 7-7 overall. Then they have to go play in this scenario. They'd be 0-4 in ACC. They'd be the odd man out of the four-team tournament. They would be the fifth seed, and they would play Brown in a playing game. It's a must-win game for their NCAA tournament hopes. Not only do they get a good RPI win,
Oh, yeah, no. They'd be playing for their lives.
Right, because if you can't make the tournament with a losing record, sub-500 record. So, yeah, it would be their first NCAA tournament game is the way they would have to look at that.
Exactly.
Okay, moving on. We have some other games this week, Terry. Lots of TV action, which is great. ESPN 3, North Carolina and Syracuse, 4 o'clock. CBS Sports Network on Saturday.
Triple header.
Yeah.
Shout out.
Navy and Army in what a lot of people consider the best rivalry in lacrosse. And how about the academies this season? We have 3 teams in the top 20 right now. Navy and Army are probably the two best or up right up there.
maybe they're two of the three best.
Yeah, they're two of the three best. And they have a big game at noon in a big rivalry, which will be fun to watch. Cornell and Lehigh following that on CBS Sports Network at 2:30, and Georgetown and Villanova at 5 on the Big Ten Network Saturday. Michigan State.
Nope.
Excuse me. Michigan and Ohio State.
Michigan State would be awesome.
Michigan and Ohio State in another big rivalry game at 11 a.m. And then on Sunday at noon, ESPN2, we talked about it, Duke and Virginia in a big game for both teams. And then at 7 o'clock, primetime on the Big Ten Network, Johns Hopkins at Penn State to close off the weekend slate.
Awesome subtext to that one is that Dave Petromala and Jeff Tamburini are very, very close. Yeah. Jeff was an assistant for David Cornell. And so, after Dave went to Johns Hopkins, they didn't play. They could have played. They would have been great opponents. But they decided that they just wanted to scrimmage at the beginning of most seasons, if not all. So now they don't have a choice. They have to play each other. And obviously with what both coaches and staffs have endured over the last year, certainly a lot of emotion being a part of this coaching matchup.
Terry, that takes us to new words to live by, and you want to talk about Mike Posner as your theme song for the weekend.
It was kind of an anthem. The Took a Pill in Ibiza song was an anthem for the weekend, and it was stuck in my head. I mean, I was watching the Penn State Maryland game and I just couldn't get it out. I was like, I almost wanted to figure out a way that I could do like the split screen mm-hmm. thing just so I could listen to it once to get it outside of my brain. You had an encounter with this young man.
Well, not with him. I saw him in Cameron at a Duke game. I was sitting,
so he's a Duke alum.
Yeah. I was sitting with somebody, and they pointed out there were some other players or something before the game. He was on the court. I don't know if he was singing the national anthem before the game. I don't remember. But I just remember someone who works at Duke was like, oh, that's Mike Posner. He's like a singer.
Well, I wanted to bring it up because I don't think a lot of people know that Cooler Than Me, his breakthrough hit, was written about a girl who I don't know what the nature of the relationship was, but was in a relationship with the Duke lacrosse player.
And how'd you find this out, Terry?
I was told.
By Mike?
I can't disclose my sources. Yeah, exactly. This is when I was doing a side gig for Spin.
a Duke lacrosse player told you this?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. So you have the quote, Terry. You said that you couldn't get the song out of your head.
So again, the line that just kept going and going.
And again,
going.
Terry was at a bachelor party this weekend, and the line...
No, I want you to say it.
Okay. It's, I'm a real big baller because I made $1 million and I spent it on girls and shoes.
Yep. Those are words to live by, man.
And that's our pod for the week. Thanks for listening, as always, and enjoy the games.
I took a pill in Ibiza to show Avicii I was cool. And when I finally got sober, felt 10 years older, but it was something to do. I'm living out in L.A. I drive a sports car just to prove I'm a real big baller because I made $1 million and I spend it on girls and shoes. But you don't want to be high like me, never really know why like me. You don't ever want to step off that roller coaster and be all alone. And you don't wanna ride the bus like this, never know who to trust like this. You don't wanna be stuck up on that stage singing, stuck up on that stage singing. Oh, I know a sad soul, sad soul. Darling, oh, I know a sad soul, sad soul.